Okay, we have now reached the time for our fifth and final oral argument this morning. And as you're getting set up there, counsel, I'll call the case. The case is State of Minnesota versus Mark Michael Mosley. And the case number is 8221073. And counsel, I know you're both very familiar with the rules here. I'll go over them again. Nonetheless, appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are making an audio recording of the argument, and so I ask that you please identify yourself and the party you're representing for the benefit of that audio recording. And with that, if you're both ready to go, we may go ahead with the arguments.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Kelly Moeller, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney representing the state in this pretrial appeal. The issue before this court is whether there was probable cause to search respondent's car where a confidential, reliable informant with a proven track record personally observed the driver, the sole occupant of the car, possessing a gun and selling marijuana. My argument today will address three things. First, I'd like to highlight the case law regarding the probable cause standard when information is provided by the CRI. Second, I'll describe how the facts in this case satisfy that standard. And finally, I'll describe the flaws in the district court's order suppressing the evidence. Looking first at the case law, under well-established precedent, when probable cause is based on information provided by a CRI, courts look at the totality of the circumstances, including both the reliability of the informant and the CRI's basis of knowledge. Reliability can be established with a proven track record, and that's not really much of an issue in this case. Really, the issue in this case is the CRI's basis of knowledge.
Can I just, as to the reliability of the CRI in this case, there is a fact that that I haven't seen much, and that is that the fact that the informant was paid for the information, and that was reflected in the findings of facts that the district court made, but not in its analysis, at least that I saw, is the fact that the informant was paid, you know, albeit a reliable informant, relevant to the issue of reliability, which an issue we're reviewing de novo on appeal.
Yeah, thanks, Your Honor. I haven't really seen that mentioned in case law either. I don't really think it cuts one way or the other because the cases are so focused on the proven track record of the informant. And in this case, we had Sergeant Schroeder testifying that this information was always timely, accurate, and reliable. The information provided by this CRI had been used in dozens of arrests, charges, and convictions. So I think that's more of the emphasis rather than the fact that this particular CRI was paid. You know, I guess it just maybe further establishes that this is someone that law enforcement has a lot of trust in because they're paying this particular informant. But I think those other factors are probably the most relevant to the reliability. Looking again at the case law, so the reliability is one part of it, and then the basis of knowledge is the other. And this court in Cook said that basis of knowledge can be established in one of two ways. First, it can be supplied directly by firsthand information. For example, when the CRI states that he or she saw the suspect engaging in illegal activity. Other decisions, too, by this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have reiterated that. Recent personal observation of incriminating conduct has traditionally been the preferred basis for the informant's knowledge. And then this court in Holiday said, quote, an informant's statement that the event was observed firsthand entitles his tip to greater weight than might otherwise be the case. And then I think Rosario, which is non-precedential, but does kind of build upon this, reiterates this, and says a CRI's firsthand observation of a suspect selling drugs provides a sufficient basis of knowledge for probable cause. And in that case, the CRI's firsthand account was a, quote, textbook example of a basis of knowledge sufficient for probable cause. So if you have that, you've got the direct establishment. Then the case law talks about, alternatively, if you don't have that direct firsthand information, then the basis of knowledge can be supplied indirectly through details that allow the inference that the information was obtained reliably and wasn't based on some sort of rumor or reputation in the community. Ross and Munson were cases where the basis of knowledge of the CRI wasn't provided, so the courts there delved into sort of this sort of the inference that needed to be made in those cases. The U.S. Supreme Court has also said that deficiency in either one of those things, reliability or basis of knowledge, can also be compensated for by a strong showing of the other one. Specifically in Gates, the Supreme Court said, there gave an example, if an informant is unusually reliable, failure to set forth the basis of knowledge is not an absolute bar to probable cause. And then I think deficiency of reliability or basis of knowledge, either one of those things, that's when the court really delves into additional corroborating information in order to make sure that the informant is either reliable, as in the case of when there are anonymous tips or tips by CIs who aren't CRIs, courts really delve into that corroboration to make sure that info is reliable, or they look at additional corroborating factors when that basis of knowledge isn't known. And Cook is the prime example of that case.
How did the evidence that, or how did the officers at the scene's observation, and I can't remember the guy, the second officer who was there and chatting with the respondent for some amount of time while observing other people engaged in apparent drug dealing, how were those officers' observations, how did they predict, how were they predictive at all that the respondent was engaged in?
Yeah, so I believe you're talking about Officer Gregory's conversation
yes.
with Mr. Mosley at Winter Gas Station. They were commenting and laughing about the fact that there was somebody there selling drugs openly in front of the
right.
officer's presence. Actually, that information corroborates the information that the CRI provided because it, A, corroborates that Mr. Mosley was, in fact, at Winter Gas Station, was there. We don't know the timing of when that conversation took place, but at least was there talking to an officer prior to when the officers who stopped the car arrived and saw the car leaving. And then the fact that Mr. Mosley thought it was funny somebody was doing this right in the officer's presence certainly suggests that he wouldn't be making that same mistake. And then I'll also note that the CRI's tip was that he saw Mr. or the driver of the car with the gun inside the car. And so presumably that would have been outside of an officer's presence because his observation was inside the car.
I can understand how it's not inconsistent with the CRI's tip, but how I'm struggling with how it corroborates the tip.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's really that relevant of a factor. But I think in addressing it, the district court and Mr. Mosley suggests that it somehow detracts from the reliability of the tip because it suggests that they got the person wrong, that because they were talking, the CRI must have been talking about this other person, and it certainly doesn't detract from the basis of knowledge or the reliability of the tip. And also just note that there was evidence that this particular location was an area where there were a lot of crimes and a lot of drug transactions. So just because another drug transaction was taking place that Officer Gregory and Mr. Mosley saw doesn't mean that Mr. Mosley was not also selling drugs at this location.
Can I ask, so it seems to me that the theory of the state as to the warrant exception that applies here is the automobile exception. Am I right about that?
Yes.
You're not arguing search incident to arrest?
No, that's right.
Okay, so if we're in the universe of that exception, I'm just wondering what the contraband was that allowed the officers to seize the car and do a search.
Right, so two things, Your Honor. One was the marijuana, and the other was the firearm.
Okay, so with regard to the firearm, the tip contained no information about Mr. Mosley's identity. So how was the firearm contraband in this case?
Yep, so I think the Williams case is really, I think I'm getting that case name right, that talks about a firearm itself. It's a gross misdemeanor to carry a firearm in public, and then having a permit to carry is an affirmative defense. So I think Williams sort of addresses why just having the firearm in and of itself is a cause for concern, a basis for suspicion. But here we have the CRI saying that not only did he see the driver of this car possessing the gun in the car, but the driver of this car was also selling marijuana. So I'd say both of those things are what allow the officers or give the officers probable cause to search.
But not independently?
I'm not sure, because they're both here, and the way that the CRI gave the information, or at least the way Sergeant Schrader testified about it, was that they were sort of happening together.
The probable cause was that there was going to be a criminal amount of marijuana, and that arguably this person didn't have a permit to carry the firearm?
Well, that the person was selling marijuana, so the sell is different than possession of, a petty misdemeanor amount of marijuana. Here we have selling, and I would say, under the statutes, if you're selling...
But I thought that this was under the automobile exception. So the sale, what would the sale have to do with it? I thought we were in the universe of contraband.
You had just mentioned petty amount. So I'm just talking about, yes, probable cause to search a car for, it, under the case law, even if an officer smells marijuana, that gives them probable cause to search a car. So I guess regardless of the amount here, you've got both the selling of the marijuana and the firearm. I do want to talk a minute about the facts here about the personal observation that give this CRI the basis of knowledge. And that is, Officer Schroeder testified that the informant contacted me and told me that he or she had personally observed a male in possession of a firearm inside a vehicle. The person was selling marijuana and possessing a firearm with an extended magazine. Stated that this male in possession of the handgun and selling marijuana was alone in the vehicle, gave the license plate number, and that the informant personally observed the driver in possession of a firearm. The CRA provided this information contemporaneously with what they were observing at Winter Gas. And the fact that the CRI could describe the gun with an extended magazine and that the drugs specifically were marijuana, I think just further enhances that this was a personal observation. There was also additional corroboration here. The car was the one described by the CRI. We know that based on the license plate provided. The CRI said it was a black male, was the sole occupant, and was the driver. And the car was located where the CRI saw it at Winter Gas Station. Importantly, too, and one thing that the district court didn't acknowledge, although found this fact to be correct, was when the police tried to stop Mr. Mosley, he continued about three-quarters of a block, which Sergeant Polkley testified was consistent in his experience with someone either trying to hide something or obtain a weapon. So additional corroboration was not needed because of the reliability of the informant and the basis of knowledge here. The district court's order, really the biggest flaw with the court's order is that it failed to acknowledge that the CRI's information was based on personal observation. Both the district court and Mr. Mosley appear to apply a heightened corroboration requirement beyond that's required by case law. They seem to suggest that the informant had to predict future behavior or had to provide an identity. But a lot of those cases have to deal with situations where there was no basis of knowledge established. And this court in Holiday said there's no requirement that certain facts have to be corroborated. The court also made an erroneous finding of fact with respect to whether or not money was found. So Sergeant Polkley testified that they didn't inventory any money. If you watch the video of the stop here, after the police found the gun, they search Mr. Mosley again. You can see on video they're holding up a wad of cash, and they say, we're not going to inventory this. We're going to let you take this to jail, Mr. Mosley. So there was cash. It just wasn't inventoried. In my view of the video, that was at 1949. I don't know if your court exhibit matches up with the same video that I saw, but it was after the gun was found and before Officer Gregory arrived at the scene where that money was seen. So, based on the reliability of the informant in this case and the fact that the CRI's information was based on personal observation, plus the corroboration we had here, there was probable cause to search the car in this case.
Thank you. And we will now hear from counsel for a respondent.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the respondent in this case, Mr. Mark Mosley. The quite apparently controlling case law related to this appeal, that being Cook, Ross, and Munson, all of it, whether because of the holdings or the analysis or both, paints a much brighter line of law relating to warrantless arrests and searches than appellant is allowing for here. The district court's order displays, I believe very clearly, good familiarity with the standards that this court has set and the Supreme Court has set relating to the issues in this case. And I would emphasize here that this involved more than just the warrantless search of my client's vehicle. Sergeant Puckley testified that he pulled over a vehicle that just matched the description. He did not describe who he saw in it, nothing about the person in it, and that he immediately performed a warrantless arrest. In his own words, he said that once the car pulled over, the driver was ordered out. Sergeant Puckley had his weapon drawn, and he took him into custody. He arrested him. There was a need for probable cause for that. I am noting in appellant's written arguments, there is a lot of emphasis and reliance on cases like Wiley and Holiday, which were search warrant cases. I think that that's a distinction that needs to be emphasized here.
Well, and in fact, the district court noted that in its order, right? That in a close case, the fact that you don't get a warrant is...
You get a judge intervening and examining and making a determination. The thing that I am naturally concerned about is that police out in the field are given this authority. The Constitution requires probable cause. It prefers the intervention of a magistrate, but police have that power. Sergeant Puckley exercised it without knowing a thing about who was in that vehicle. And as the district court's order also noted, the police, I mean, maybe Sergeant Schroeder knew it, but he didn't relay it in his testimony. The police didn't even know anything about this other than he was a young black male.
So the fact they didn't have a name, is that what's lacking?
Oh, or,
I mean, they had the car, they had the location, they had the personal basis of knowledge. I mean, I know that this case, every case presents different facts, and so you're threading a needle. But I'm looking, you know, at Cook. And Cook, you know, there was a problem with the details provided by the informant didn't explain how the informant came by that person's information. This is a wholly different case.
Indeed, but the district court's order notes, and I have put here in my own notes that it seems like it's the most salient fact. It was Sergeant Schroeder who testified about what the CRI told him, but it was never explained how the CRI had this firsthand knowledge, which was the same problem in Cook. But
well, Cook is, I don't think in Cook there was any information that the informant had actually been present and personally observed any conduct. There was just an identification of a person that they were going to be at the YMCA. Here you had a couple of clear statements in the testimony that they observed it. That's the record, as I understand it, that Officer Schroeder, Sergeant Schroeder, twice said he saw it.
That was Sergeant Schroeder's testimony, but the language of Cook goes a little beyond that. Quoting directly, it says that an assessment of a CRI's basis of knowledge, the key phrase here, involves consideration of the quantity and quality of detail in the CRI's report, and then whether the police could independently verify important details. So let me just concede, the police verified the vehicle details. Sergeant Puckley didn't verify a thing about the person involved here. And at this point, I must invoke Katz v. U.S. The Fourth Amendment protects persons, not places. Sergeant Puckley didn't know a thing about who was in that car, whether it was even a black male. It wasn't even in his testimony. It was just a person described as a young black male. This is what the district court found so problematic. She said the police didn't even know when he was stopped and arrested who they were dealing with. They knew in Cook, at least because the description was accurate, and it was a much more detailed description. It wasn't just a physical description, it was a description of clothing, which matched. The only thing that fell short in Cook, really, was that Officer Doran either failed to relay or wasn't given an explanation from the CRI how he knew it.
But okay. And I agree, but as we've said earlier, I mean, this is a totality of the circumstances sort of decision. And so, yes, in Cook you had perhaps more detail about a physical description, but you had no information about the CRI's basis of knowledge. Here we have that box checked off, right? But different circumstances described by the CRI, different levels of detail. I mean, isn't part of the totality analysis saying, you know, a deficiency in one area may be made up with, information provided in another?
Well, I welcome the totality of circumstances analysis here because of the additional information the police provided, namely that Sergeant Schroeder admitted that at any given moment you'll see 10, 12 people dealing marijuana at Winter, and Sergeant Puckley also established that he very likely knew how the CRI knew this, but he refused to provide it. He wouldn't say because he was worried about somehow endangering disclosing the identity of his CRI. So that results in the same effect that happened in Cook, whether it was by Officer Doran's intentional omission or not in that case. But the totality of the circumstances.
So not identifying the CRI is what you said means there was no, that we can't put the basis of knowledge on the side of probable cause?
I'm just citing that was Sergeant Schroeder's rationale for not providing information that he clearly had, and had he given, I might not even be here. This was the district court's concern. I mean, I noted in appellant's reply brief that there seems to be a conflation or an equivalency here being drawn between personal knowledge and basis of knowledge. I mean, if I stand here and cite personal knowledge about a statute or a case, the three of you are going to want to know how I know that.
Isn't the problem that anybody could say they saw anything and without information about how they saw it, there's going to be concern about the reliability of that information?
That's the rub here, and that's why I chose to emphasize more of the facts of Munson and Ross. I mean, look at the work the police did in that case. Seemed like police who were aware of, it's important that they get probable cause right. They got the identity of these suspects. Well, two out of three in Munson, but the other one in Ross. And they just did Terry stops at first. And then they verified the ID of the person before they arrested them. Sergeant Puckley testified, page 26, that he just arrested the person in the vehicle immediately, took him into custody, sight unseen. That, to me, is where this problem really starts, and then it ends. Because once you have an illegal arrest without probable cause, anything that happens after that, including a vehicle search that might otherwise be allowable under the automobile exception, is unlawful. Sergeant Puckley needed to do more homework. Okay, Sergeant Schroeder wasn't on duty that night, so he called Sergeant Puckley and said, we got this vehicle, this license plate. The person in it has a gun and drugs. Well, who? That's all Sergeant Puckley had to ask. Do we know who this person is? He didn't even know what he looked like. So I think Cook and Munson and Ross stand for a standard of police knowledge that wasn't met here. Okay, this isn't about the standard of a CRI's knowledge. I agree about the paid aspect. I too wondered about that, but since the district court, I think she just didn't feel the need to reach that issue because there was such insufficient information here. But the governing standard here is not simply what a CRI knew. That's why this quote from Cook that I just gave, said that assessing their basis of knowledge includes whether police independently verify important details of the informant's report. The vehicle make, color, and license plate here was the least important aspect here. They needed to know who they were about to arrest without a warrant. Mr. Mosley had the right for the police to be held to that standard before he was just yanked out of the car at gunpoint and arrested. So if this court were to apply the analysis that can clearly be seen from Munson and Ross, and note what wasn't done here, what wasn't known by the police, and then, as the district court in this case said, note the similarity to Cook here, though the district court felt that this case didn't even rise to the level of Cook because, again, of the lack. I mean, I was startled to see Sergeant Schroeder make the admission on the stand that you got a dozen people at any given moment selling drugs at Winter, and
So doesn't the location of the car there, in fact, corroborate the CRI's tip that I was, you know, this person is selling drugs, and he has a gun, and this is where he is?
No, because of Cook. That was the problem in Cook, too. The car was stationary. It was at a single location that anybody could see.
Thought Cook, the more of the problem in Cook was that it's at a YMCA. There's no reason to think that a car parked by a YMCA.
Well, a gas station is a place you could more readily and easily find a car to be for innocuous reasons than a YMCA.
Although this particular one apparently is well known to be a drug dealing location, right?
Yes,
I mean, I'm just saying that's a difference between Cook and this case, it seems to me.
I've used that gas station. I think it's important that we not allow ourselves to assume that everyone there is there to go and deal drugs. The predictive aspect of the information in Ross and Munson were key. Okay, the CRI did not only provide identity information, but said the car is going to be here at this time to do a drug deal. Same thing happened in Ross. Showed up at the place they said it would. I have learned enough from litigating these issues before this court that predictive information is essential, and that is a key component of the Munson case that Cook noted was also lacking. The point of Cook, and I think the district court adopted it here, is that easily verifiable details, you know, that's not usually going to suffice out on the street. Now, if a judge intervenes and issues a search warrant by deciding that, well, I just don't see how that standard is even relevant here. The cases like Wiley and Holiday. I note counsel has cited the Rosario case. I didn't recall seeing that in any of the briefs, but a quick glance at it here, that also is a search warrant case. But there, the police did verify, you know, three essential details, okay? It was the address, the physical appearance, and the description of the vehicle. Even there, we've got more than we had here. I think it's important to remember that the focus really doesn't even have to be on Sergeant Schroeder here. He was just the messenger. It's what Puckley knew at the moment he decided to arrest my client. He didn't know anything about him, except maybe that he was a black male. That's a dangerously broad or low threshold for just simply deciding to arrest someone. We can't even tell from the CRI's input in this case whether it was the same person in the vehicle, and that's why I felt Officer Gregory was so important. I think defense counsel was right at the hearing. If Officer Gregory was standing there and talking to my client right around the time that this tip was given, was he just openly in possession of a weapon with an extended magazine and dealing marijuana with Officer Gregory saying, "So what?" I don't think so. It could have been anybody else at that lot, which is what Sergeant Schroeder's testimony helps provide. Sergeant Puckley, if he had handled this situation differently, I mean, but even if he had done a Terry stop, just done a regular traffic stop and approached without his weapon drawn and said, "Good evening, sir, can I see your license?" even if he had started asking questions about who he was, again, he had no idea who this person was. It could have been a black male, it could have been a white male, Hispanic, he didn't know. There's a brighter line at work here under Cook, Munson, and Ross. The police didn't meet it. The prosecution has not been able to show that they did. There was no probable cause for my client's arrest and vehicle search. Thank you.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'll start by saying that Cook, Ross, and Munson all involved a case where there was no personal observation. There was no basis of knowledge in any of those three cases.
But what about the point I was making with Mr. Maravilli that anyone could just say they personally observed something? How is that in and of itself corroborating?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First, it's not just anyone here. This is a confidential, reliable informant who has a proven track record, and we had testimony about that. So this isn't just anyone saying that. And second, we have the case law says personal observation is the textbook example of how you establish basis of knowledge. It doesn't go on to say you have to say that what that particular personal observation is. And some of these cases, I was in a house and I saw drugs. Well, this case was he saw the driver of the car with a firearm with an extended magazine. So we have a CRI who has a known track record who gave information about personally observing the incriminating behavior. So requiring more is beyond what case law requires. I think one of the things I want to address as well is that I'm always used to being respondent. Sorry. Mr. Mosley here talks about the probable cause to arrest this particular person. And in this case, the CRI talked about the fact that it was the driver, the sole occupant of the car with this particular license. So the fact that we don't have the identity of the driver doesn't matter in this determination because it was the driver, the sole occupant of the car with this particular driver's plate, and that's what the police saw when they stopped Mr. Mosley's vehicle.
Although Mr. Maravilli says they didn't know who they were stopping because there was no, they didn't know, they didn't see who was in the car, whether he was alone, no description.
Well, but they saw that this car, and again, the information from the CRI was that it was at Winter Gas Station, so that was consistent with the CRI's tip that it was at Winter Gas Station. I don't believe he was asked whether or not he knew there was one occupant. Certainly at the time they stopped the car, at that point, they did see that there was one occupant. I'm not sure there was testimony on when they observed when there was one occupant. But it was leaving Winter Gas Station, so we know that that was consistent with the tip. We also had the testimony that he didn't stop immediately but drove about 3/4 of a block before pulling over. And then when they stopped it, he clearly was the only person in the car, was the driver of the car.
But I think respondent's argument is that the officer made the decision to arrest before even verifying that it was a black male in the car. Is there any evidence in the record that he had verified that fact from the CRI before deciding to arrest?
I don't think there is evidence in the record from that, but I'm trying to go back and think about the video too and what's whether or not that could be observed on the video. But again, the CRI's information, though, was that it was the driver of the car was the one in possession of the gun inside the car with that particular license plate. So even without any sort of further information on that, there was probable cause in this case. The other thing I would note is that search warrant cases are, as respondent says, different from cases where there are no search warrants. Certainly, there's a de novo standard of review here that wouldn't exist. You would be looking at deference applied to a warrant. But the probable cause standard itself isn't different. Whether you're looking at a case with a search warrant or not, the test for probable cause, the standard, looking at the reliability of the information from the CRI, the basis of knowledge from the CRI, all of that is the same, regardless of whether or not there's a search warrant. There was some suggestion that...
Can I just ask a question? So as the district court noted, the Cook case says, in a close call, in a case that's factually close, the lack of a warrant may weigh against a finding of probable cause. Do we know how the district court weighed that factor into its analysis here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the lack of which factor?
Oh, the Cook case says the lack of a search warrant can weigh against a finding of probable cause. When an officer is relying on an exception to the warrant requirement, it's you know, potentially gonna be to the detriment of the officer in the analysis that's conducted later.
Yeah, I think the courts that, I mean, there, I don't think there's any dispute about what that case law is. I think where the court went awry, though, was not looking at basis of knowledge. And that's where the court's decision is very inconsistent with what this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court said about the reliability of a tip and the basis of knowledge. And so in our position, it is not a close case. And for those reasons, this court should reverse the district court's order suppressing the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame. It's nice to see